Shropshire Hall, Edinburgh. All the Scottish coalfields organized parties to the capital that evening, by rail and by road. They arrived in their hundreds. That evening, the miners came to see Robeson. But the same afternoon, Paul Robeson had been to the miners. Accompanied by the area agent, colliery manager, and union officials, he kept a dinner date in the canteen at Woolmot Colliery on the outskirts of Edinburgh.
Paul Robeson, international citizen, an African American, as you heard him say. He's an American citizen, yes, but he's an African American.
Alive as you and me, says I, but Joel, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Paul Robeson, portrait of the artist, for a $250 contribution right now. Make your calls now. You can pledge any amount to WBAI. A $50 contribution, absolutely. You'll become a member of this radio station, this commercial-free, listener-sponsored community radio station. But $250 will send you this box set, and it is an amazing, amazing box set. Portrait of the artist, all kinds of historical materials and pamphlet involved in that package. $250. Make your calls right now. 516-620-3602. I'm excited just for your call that I know that's going to come in just a moment. I'm really excited. Wish I was there to take that call myself. Hope we can get back to that. 516-620-3602. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Just about 10 o'clock, we'll move on to some additional fundraising programming here on WBAI.
I never died, says
he. And the calls are coming in. Yeah, calls are coming in for Paul Robeson, portrait of the artist. Please continue to make these calls right now. You have made me so very happy. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM, and you can catch us all over planet Earth at WBAI.org. We're streaming 24 hours a day, thanks to listeners just like you. My goodness, you should be proud of yourself, just as proud as I am of you. 516-620-3602.
Yes, thanks to everybody who's calling in right now. In fact, some of you might be calling in for us off the hook, because we are the next program that's on the air here at WBAI New York. It's 8 o'clock and time for another action-packed edition of Off the Hook.
Understood. Bundle it low.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello.
And Alex.
Good evening.
And Alex, congratulations are in order.
Perhaps, that's right.
You have a new offspring?
I do indeed. It is amazing what you can make in 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, well, I'm not going to get into that, but a lot of congratulatory messages lately.
I know.
People getting married, people having kids.
It's true. It's amazing. That's why I wasn't on the air last week, because we just had a newborn baby. And I'm happy to report that he is extraordinarily healthy. He was pretty huge, 8 pounds, 10 ounces. And my wife is doing really well. We're just exhausted.
Congratulations on getting married.
Yes. I was
finding a place in New York to live.
Yeah. And all these things.
Anything else I might have left out over the years? Congratulations on that.
Yes. I graduated high school.
Now, congratulations. I wasn't sure. I didn't want to be rude and ask. That's okay.
Yeah.
22 years ago. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm unforgivably late on that. I got 40 miles per gallon on the highway the other day. That's worthy of commendation, I think.
I was getting 52 in my diesel.
You know, Alex, you've always had this, need to top me on everything.
Well, just saying. But it was on Kyle's recommendation that I bought the engine that I did, so I do have both of you to thank for that, really.
And dropped it into a car, and now it's moving.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, good. We're off to a flying start here tonight, and we have a lot to talk about, and kind of a skeleton crew, I guess, because everyone's out celebrating the hot, muggy weather.
Yeah, and to go back to the baby thing, by the way.
Sure, because, let's go right back to that.
By the way, this is the first announcement that we've made about this publicly. You know, usually you have this obligatory Facebook post that you need to do.
To stay under the radar, and I messed it up for you.
No, it's okay. You know,
the kid's got to have a Facebook account now, and he'll be tweeting before you know it.
God, don't remind me. But we didn't do this for the first time. I mean, we've only had one other child, but we deliberately kept this all off of Facebook. So for a lot of my friends, this may be the first way that they're hearing about it.
Wow.
As a matter of fact. But with all this
nonsense, they must have known something was going to happen, though. You kind of didn't keep that secret for the last few months.
Well, we also kept that a bit under wraps.
Really?
Except for the fact that my wife was pregnant came out when somebody posted a picture of us in Italy, and it was readily apparent that she was pregnant. But we deliberately didn't post this on Facebook because of why do we have to tell Facebook? Why do we have to announce this to Facebook?
Yeah, I did ask you before the show if it's okay to talk about this. I did ask, just so everybody knows that. All
yes,
right?
That's true.
I'm not blowing your cover here.
No. Yeah, but I think that the radio is a much more appropriate announcement for that than Facebook.
Well, you know,
so
it used to be in the old days you could keep something like this under wraps, I don't know why you would want to specifically, but you didn't have to tell the world. And with Facebook and with Twitter and with all these other social media outlets, it's very hard to keep news like the birth of a kid quiet or secret.
Exactly. And you feel this compulsion or this obligation to post this up and let everybody know and comment on it and like it. And it gives you some sort of immediate gratification to see all of this. But we didn't do it this time.
Well, your baby gets the most likes in the first week. And if you miss that first week,
I know,
you know, it kind of sets it's a bad first step. You know,
but
for
it's
the
a
rest
different
of its life.
Well, that's true, but we're setting a different precedent now. We don't have to share this information with Facebook. They don't need to know about the birth of my child.
Oh, they know. They know, Alex. They know.
they probably
know more than you think they do.
This is probably true.
Good luck with all of that is basically all I'm going to say. And I would say to E that don't feel so bad, because whatever mileage he's getting better is completely offset by the carbon footprint of this other child.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for true. That. That's what I needed
extra,
to hear.
The extra drag that another 9 pounds is going to cause in the back seat.
Oh, it's 9 pounds now.
Yes,
Yeah, it'll increase undoubtedly
if you keep feeding them.
So we have a lot of other things to talk about tonight too. Believe it or not, all sorts of developments in the world of technology. Some controversial, actually, all controversial. Okay, let's just start with this. We know about net neutrality being repealed earlier.
Challenged.
Well, it's been repealed. I mean, it's pretty much dead at this point.
Yeah, the Restore Internet Freedom Act, which had nothing to do with internet freedom, but the freedom to charge you for a fast and slow lane, was passed.
Right, right. Well, anyway, the FCC, as we know, repealed net neutrality rules earlier this year. Now the Trump administration wants to go even further. Last Thursday, the Solicitor General requested that the Supreme Court vacate a 2016 ruling from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that holds that the net neutrality rules enacted during the Obama years permissibly reclassified broadband as a telecommunications service subject to regulation under Title II of the Communications Act. So what does that mean, Alex? Legally, they want to basically vacate it never happened?
Yeah, vacating means it is as if it didn't happen in the first place, right? So they are basically destroying the foundation of net neutrality, and, you know, even in the common law. So they passed a statute, the Restore Internet Freedom Act, and then there were these vestiges of net neutrality that existed in the common law, and they're asking the Supreme Court to take those out as well. And it's just, you know, part and parcel, I think, of the Trump administration trying to roll back anything and everything that the Obama administration did, mm-hmm. regardless of whether or not it makes sense.
Yeah, it's like perverse, the level of hatred. Like, anything done pre-Trump is like invalid. And it's so cringy and like, it's just awful to watch anymore because it's all about ego.
Cringy. That's the word for this era. I was looking for a word like cringy. Yes, that's it. Write that down.
The interesting thing about this is they're asking for the decision of the D.C. Circuit to be reversed, right?
Right, right.
I believe John Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee, comes from the D.C. Circuit as well. Or I actually can't recall if he's federal district court or if he was the circuit court.
You might be right. I'm not sure.
But I do know it was in that particular circuit. So, you know, it could be somewhat controversial. And also, it's important to note that the D.C. Circuit is one of the circuits in the United States that carries with it a tremendous amount of clout. And especially when it comes to the legal decisions that affect agencies' rights, you know, federal agencies. And they are literally the subject matter experts in the world when it comes to federal administrative law. So asking the Supreme Court to overturn a decision that affects a federal agency and federal rulemaking processes that comes from the D.C. Circuit is a pretty tall ask.
Well, so now, if this happens, if they are able to vacate this ruling, how does that affect future possible rollbacks to restoring net neutrality?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it just makes everything a lot easier, right? There is no thorny common law that's going to stop this from proceeding. People will not be able to point to this particular decision that's on the books in the D.C. Circuit. They're only going to have the Restore Internet Freedom Act to look to when it comes to rules about net neutrality or the lack thereof. So it will make it will allow communications carriers to more easily roll out these particular plans without facing legal challenges. That's my guess on it. I actually haven't read the entire decision that they're asking to be vacated, but that's generally what happens when something is vacated.
Well, we just have a surprise guest here. Cheshire Catalyst, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I heard rumors that you were locked in your hotel room for the last 2 weeks, and apparently you just got out. Hotel Pennsylvania. Is that what happened?
No. I'm on a 30-day Amtrak rail pass, and after the conference, I went up to Rochester, New York to my high school class 50th reunion.
Interesting. We just dropped a lot of information about yourself. Now I know you went to high school in Rochester.
Yep.
With that information, I can find out even more about your history.
You can.
And
wow.
He's either 67 or 68.
Well, he could have been a prodigy, though. He could have graduated at 9.
That's true. He doesn't look a day over 51.
All right. No all doubt. Right. But,
hey,
cool.
And no cracks about the color of my hair. I live in Florida now, so it's sun bleached. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it's good to see you. First time I think I've seen you since the conference. Actually, I didn't see you much during the conference because we were just so busy. And
absolutely.
Wow. But I hope you had fun at your reunion.
I did. Oh, it was great. Not only to see who was there, but to see who remembered me and for what.
Okay, I'm sure there are some stories there as well.
There are. I'm not sure I want to put them on the radio.
Wow. Okay, well, let's continue with the things we were discussing here. We were talking about the FCC, actually. Yes, Kyle.
Yeah, well, I felt like it just seemed like that what's happening is that also by taking these other precedents out of vacating them in this way, it's sort of makes it an uphill battle to start over as far as introducing this. Were you to want net neutrality again, you would not be able to refer to it in the same way that it's opening and taking away barriers at these lesser levels, it is also that much more of a difficult job to restore this in any way in the future, like going forward, because you won't be able to refer to it.
That's a really excellent point, and you're right. I mean, it's like cracking at the foundation of net neutrality.
Yeah, it's they got it to the sort of pedestal or the as enshrined as it was in implementation before, it just reverts in as many ways.
That's right. And, you know, I haven't read the brief, but I would imagine that the brief would say something like, well, Congress has enacted, and this is a legislative pronouncement, and now you can vacate this prior decision because essentially the check on the court is Congress. So it's a series of checks and balances.
Could that even be used as argument or precedent against saying like, look, this was taken apart, this was vacated, this was removed and once upon a time, so why on earth would we try to, it would be foolish to go in this path again, which really kind of closes the door on it, as this has been gutted.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, it will make it much more difficult for anybody raising these particular types of challenges.
They'll have to come up with other sort of rationales and pathways.
Arguments. Well, if the day of sanity comes, you know, down the road a little bit, I imagine there'll be a lot of this reconstruction happening, and this will be just another challenge. But sticking with the FCC for a moment, you guys remember that they reported they were hacked. Their comment system was hacked during this whole net neutrality discussion. Well, it turns out that never happened. In fact, you know, a lot of us doubted that from the start. But they've come clean on the fact that a purported hack of its comment system last year never actually took place after a report from its own inspector general found a lack of evidence supporting the idea. But that doesn't mean that it still can't be blamed on Obama, because Chairman Ajit Pai blamed the former chief information officer and the Obama administration for providing inaccurate information about this incident to me, my office, Congress, and the American people. The semi-apology and finger-pointing are a disappointing conclusion to the year-long web of obfuscation that the FCC has woven. Yes, from TechCrunch. Since the first moment it was reported that there was a hack of the system, there have been questions about the nature, scale, and response to it that the FCC has avoided, even under direct congressional questioning. It's just incredible to me how dishonest, how obviously dishonest these people are. And it doesn't matter once they're caught. They just continue.
Oh, they'll just keep this going. And, you know, I read this article as well, and it just seems strange to me that the comment system itself was overwhelmed, but we don't know necessarily by what it was overwhelmed, right? Was it comments that were in favor of net neutrality, or was it the astroturfing that occurred using Americans' personal information and identities to make these bogus claims that they were opponents of net neutrality and in favor of the Restore Internet Freedom Act? And if that was the case, if it was the case that it was the astroturfing that overwhelmed the system, I think that could, frankly, be considered some form of attack, because they exploited a vulnerability in the system, namely a vulnerability that allowed the exploitation of the personal identifying information of Americans to be used in this particular manner, and then overwhelmed the system in a way that ordinary people that were in favor of net neutrality couldn't use it.
Yeah, you could say that, Alex, and I think that's a good possibility. But also, it's a possibility that there are so many people arguing in favor of preserving net neutrality that they overwhelmed the system.
Exactly.
And that's considered an attack by the Trump administration. People yes, expressing yes. their opinions on something.
Right.
No, literally, if you look at how they react to anybody expressing their opinions when it doesn't align with theirs, it's an attack, you know, and it's something that needs to be stopped. So that's how they dealt with it. I'm sorry, Cheshire, you had something?
Yes, you're right. If it's not our opinion as promulgated by Fox, then it's not an informed decision.
No, that's
the way they look at it.
That's pretty much how they do look at it. There's some good news. There's some good news here, where something, an injustice is being corrected, to a degree anyway. People who end up in jail in New York City will now be able to use the phone lines there for free, after Mayor Bill de Blasio signed a bill into law on Monday that will eliminate the charge. City had been collecting about $5 million per year from calls made by incarcerated people and their families. The billion-dollar prison phone industry has drawn increased scrutiny in recent years, and the move by New York City is part of a nationwide push from prison rights groups, public defenders, and the families of those who are incarcerated to limit private companies from profiting off incarceration. The city has been profiting from some of the poorest and most vulnerable New Yorkers for years, said Corey Johnson, the city council speaker and sponsor of the bill. Thankfully, that is now going to stop. Now, interestingly, calls from Rikers Island cost 50 cents for the first minute, 5 cents for each additional minute to local numbers. And that adds up, but it's nothing compared to what happens in some prisons where it's a dollar a minute in many cases or more. So this is great. This is good to see. But the rate of calls, the per minute charge there is nothing compared to things I've seen over the years.
It's really terrible. And they are these institutions are now even charging for things like these kind of Skype visits that are occurring between family members. Some prisons don't actually let you have in-person visitation
anymore. Yeah, you have to visit by Skype.
Via Skype and video chat or whatever the hell they're using for that. And then there's a charge for that as well. I mean, all of this is just so unconscionable.
Which wouldn't ordinarily be assessed.
Right.
As a per-call or duration rate.
Absolutely.
Skype has never been that way.
It's just data, yeah. Right? I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, what's interesting to me is it's $5 million a year to the city, right? I mean, that's like half an hour worth of parking tickets on any weekend, you know, before 7 p.m. in the city. But, you know, this has really impacted people's lives in a really measurable way. And you know who was charging, you know how much they paid. I would love to see this go a step further, and I would like to see restitution made to the people who paid these exorbitant charges.
Yeah, and, you know, keep in mind, you might justify this in your mind, saying you're punishing the criminal. You're not punishing anybody except the families of the people that are trying to communicate, because they're obviously the ones who pay these ridiculous fees.
Absolutely. And this feeling of isolation, not being able to talk to them because you know it's going to be coming out of their pocket. It's going to affect the amount of food that your family can put on the table. That's just going to lead to further recidivism in the city. I mean, it's a lose-lose situation for everybody. And the meager amount of money that the city makes per year, $5 million a year, is just not worth it.
I debate the lose-lose thing, though, because recidivism is actually something that they want. Certainly, corporate prisons want this. They want people back in the system.
Sure. Lose-lose for the inmate and the family.
Yes, absolutely.
Talking about. Not necessarily the private corporation that's running the institution.
Hey, some more news here on July 27th. Sticking with the happy theme. July 27th, the National Park Service approved the historic Wardenclyffe property in Shoreham, New York, for inclusion on the National Historic Register. As we know, Wardenclyffe is the site of the Tesla Science Center. And that's a nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving and renovating the 16-acre site, which contains a brick laboratory and tower base built by inventor and humanitarian Nikola Tesla. Wardenclyffe's application for inclusion on the state and national historic registers received a record number of endorsements, over 9,500, within the week just prior to review by the New York State Division of Historic Preservation. They voted unanimously to recommend Wardenclyffe for nomination. And basically, according to their executive director, listing on the National Historic Register not only helps preserve Nikola Tesla's last remaining laboratory, but it allows us to move forward with renovations and plans to develop Wardenclyffe into a world-class science and innovation center. The NHR listing also opens doors for funding, as many grants require official historic status. Now, Kyle, we were over there during their anniversary recently.
Yeah, I would go on and on. I'll just keep it brief. But the town actually in the area, I think Coram or nearby Brookhaven, the larger area, had recognized us and has a sign hanging there. There's also a monument there from the people, I think, of Serbia, and many other parts of the place. Just the progress that the organization that has taken over that they're doing as far as developing a museum. They've restored some of the ironwork, and they had some of that on display, and they've participated with media and done TV shows and things, and done some sort of excavating and looking at some of the underground elements and talked about that on TV. Done a really great job promoting and sharing about it. We've had them. They were at Hope as well. So it's they're a real great organization that wants to fully restore the area. Of course, they had buildings that had been produced after it was a laboratory that they've also recently removed to restore it to its true original status. So they're doing this meticulously. They had, as you said, a small fundraiser out there, And there's just such enthusiasm and I guess a cool factor that is exciting and really great to see for a really deserving property and organization that wants to promote science and teach much more about this place. So it is an incredible space, a lot of honors. And this, as you said, this is an even higher honor. Now the town is backed up by a national recognition. And this, as you said, probably helps a lot with their plans to restore it. As far as getting contractors and all of that, it's much different when you're an historic entity versus mm-hmm. just a private little nonprofit trying to get some work done. This will probably allow for some outstanding work and actual classrooms and places that students can go back in time and experience the lab.
I was amazed at the celebration a month or so ago. How many people were there? How many kids were there learning about Tesla or teaching about Tesla? A lot of kids were actually telling other people what Tesla was all about, and that's just amazing to see. You can get more information going to teslasciencecenter.org. That's T-E-S-L-A, teslasciencecenter.org. Alex?
I mean, 9,500 comments on this. That's pretty amazing.
It didn't crash their system.
It didn't crash it. Did it? I was just about to ask, did this overwhelm the system to the point of classifying these comments as a DDoS attack? But, you know, failing into some incident response scenario by the National Historic Register of Buildings?
It's true. I mean, the popularity and the attraction, it's weird and kind of beautiful how the support and energy for this company, everyone wants to acknowledge a connection to Tesla, and even I think the local power company was advertising parts of their grid that used stuff that was patented at one point. Everybody's reaching for as much connection to Tesla as possible. But it's great. It's cool to see.
I had no idea that this existed over there. I mean, I grew up in Long Island. I mean, I couldn't hear properly. Was it Shoreham or was it Coram?
It was Shoreham.
It was Shoreham.
Oh, okay. I said Coram. Yeah. I get the cities wrong.
So Shoreham, Wading River, you know.
There aren't cities out there anyways.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Oh, we're going to get letters now.
Tiny towns connected by
mini cities, yes.
Strip malls. And
Shoreham used to be known for the ill-fated Shoreham nuclear power
plant.
Exactly. But now it's known for this. You know, it's a technology of a different sort. Yeah.
But it's true. I think historic name is Wardenclyffe.
Yes.
But the people of Long Island really mobilized against that nuclear power plant back in the 90s, didn't they?
Back in the 70s, try.
The 70s,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
The 90s too. I think, right?
That was one of the first things I ever got involved in. Actually, in high school, I was one of the people that scaled the fence and was a part of the demonstrations against that. So yeah, I've got a good track record of one. I've done other things too, but it was a good way to get involved, and a lot of positivity came out of that. And
hey,
still see the building; it's still there. They're dismantling it slowly.
Hey, if it's a worthy building, we'll come by. We'll help you restore it, all that. If it's not, we'll come by and shut your nuclear power plant down.
Yeah,
it's fine.
That's fair.
Anybody can get it. We're equal opportunity. Whatever, you know, whatever the scenario, we will match it and provide these services.
Yeah, and you know, they wanted to build another one out in Jamesport in Suffolk County as well, and that got rejected before they started building it. But not only that, they wanted to,
did they do one right across the water? Want to do one?
Well, they've done them in Connecticut, if that's what you mean.
Okay, okay.
But they wanted to build, for those of you in Queens, you know, the smokestacks by the Queensboro Bridge, they wanted to convert that to a nuclear power plant. That just shows you how ill-fated some of these ideas are. If you simply believe authority figures and people who claim to know about technology, sometimes they will lead you down a very bad path. And can you imagine that being a nuclear power plant right smack next to New York City? That was the plan. And fortunately, that did not go through.
A conversion. It wasn't a new facility. It was a conversion.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. I have the facts right. If any of that is incorrect, I know our listeners will write in and tell us. But anyway, we have other things to talk about, including the elephant in the room. That is Alex Jones. Wait a minute. Alex Jones is not in the room.
Everybody,
No.
I got a new show here on WBA.
No, please. Turn that down. Turn that off. No. And there's no elephant in the room, although that would be a much more easy thing to handle. This week, Alex Jones was kicked off of Facebook. And you would think it was the overthrow of a government, the reaction that you're seeing from various camps. To me, you know, I don't know what all the fuss is about. This guy has been spewing all kinds of hateful rhetoric over the years. How did it take so long for a company to realize this is toxic? This is something that we don't want to be affiliated with, that we don't need, and we have every right to kick this guy off. What do you think, Alex?
I don't necessarily agree with that, frankly. I mean, I do think that he's toxic. I think he's conspiratorial. I think that he incites people to violence. But I think he's a lunatic, frankly. But I don't think that every single statement that comes out of his mouth necessarily is an incitement to violence or
No, he orders coffee in the morning, and I'm pretty sure that's unobjectionable.
That's true, and he can continue to do that, I presume, uh-huh. without being on a podcast. But I don't necessarily agree with the wholesale censorship of somebody whose views we don't
Okay, let me stop you right there. Is it censorship with Facebook to say we don't want you on our site? I mean, to me, censorship is when the government arrests you for saying something unpopular.
Sure.
A company, you know, if we don't print an article in 2600 Magazine, is that censorship? If we edit an article, is that censorship? If we don't pick up the phone when someone's calling in and put them on the radio now, are we censoring them?
Well, it would go to the intention you have behind denying that article. Is it because you don't agree with the particular viewpoints of the article, or is it just you don't have space? Because bandwidth is not an issue for Facebook. Bandwidth isn't an issue for YouTube, who will ban him, and Spotify as well. Bandwidth is not an issue for these particular platforms. In a print magazine like 2600, you can have that legitimate excuse. However, I think that, it is dangerous to not call this censorship and to say that censorship is done only by the government, because any kind of viewpoint discrimination is censorship. Whether it's done by a private actor or the government just determines whether or not it's legally actionable. If the government censors you, then you have a First Amendment claim. If Facebook censors you, you don't have necessarily a First Amendment claim. You know, there have been rulings recently establishing that Twitter is a sort of public forum these days, so censorship by Twitter might give rise to some sort of First Amendment-related claim. But I think it's a very... And I do hate this word. It's a slippery slope that we're going down when we engage in viewpoint discrimination because we don't necessarily agree with this.
Alex, this is more than just a viewpoint. This is spreading things that are
I agree with that
are quite obviously false and designed to foster hatred and fear. I mean, you know, saying that the shooting of the kids in Connecticut is fake.
Abhorrent.
I mean, how
totally
is that
abhorrent.
Something that we consider a viewpoint?
It's insane.
Holocaust
it's
denial.
Okay.
Are we saying Holocaust denial is something that is acceptable, an acceptable
Absolutely
viewpoint?
Not.
Didn't he, like, sue some of the Sandy Hook parents, or did they sue him?
Hopefully they
kicked his ass.
I don't know what they got into, one way or the other, but I think there is something to that, the effect that the reason this hadn't been sort of policed or him otherwise disinvited from these platforms before is for the same reason he was, is that these entities were scared of his audience, and now they're scared. They're just scared for different reasons now. Like, okay, yeah, they are crazy enough and actually could do harm were he to trigger them and incite something. And the same reason before that they weren't policing was, I think, equally like from this stemming from this fear of his audience that it would fulfill and validate a narrative that he's, you know, oppressed by the state and all of this stuff and not being allowed a platform. Well, here he was given one, and we're finding ourselves in times where, you know, we don't need more stupidity and, like, you know, rage and hate out there. There's enough. Actually, the market is quite healthy in that department if you consider that discourse healthy.
But it's more than just stupidity, because there's a lot of stupid comments made all the time, and that's fine, not a big deal. But when, you know, he's not stupid. That's the thing that worries me. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he knows how to steer people into a certain direction and provoke them and manipulate them. And that's what's dangerous here. And I think it's far more dangerous to just allow that to go unimpeded and grow to the state it's grown to now than to say, you know what, you don't meet our standards, go find another platform. And that's the thing. He can find another platform. He can put up his own damn website. Nobody is saying he's not allowed to do this. Facebook and whatever other companies decided to boot him have every right to say who gets to use their system and who does not.
Two points to that. And I do think his speech is dangerous, and I think it's abhorrent, and it's an incitement to violence, and it's so incredibly idiotic, right? It doesn't have a place in my life, but if we're worried about a lack of reason here, if we're worried about the atrophy of our mental abilities to detect this kind of nonsense, this BS, then we should not be censoring this or allowing another party to determine what is heard and what is not heard on these particular platforms, because the way that you eradicate this kind of BS is not through censorship, but through reason. You see it, you identify it, you call it out, or you ignore it.
How's that working out for you in the Trump era?
It's working out perfectly fine for me.
Is it?
Absolutely.
Because yeah. I don't think just calmly shutting people down is having any effect at all. I think empowering people like Alex Jones to have this massive audience where they can spread false news and make people react to things that aren't happening,
sure,
and not react to things that are happening, that is how you wind up in a situation where immigrants are feared and racism is prevalent. Because nobody stopped it when they had the chance.
Well,
it's got nothing to do with speech, because you can say whatever you want on the corner. You can put out your own newspaper. When the government steps in and says you're not allowed to do this, yeah, I will object to that. But I do not object to any company or any outfit or any internet service saying this does not meet our standards and we don't want any part of it.
I do, though, because I think that when you censor these people, and again, 2 points, I'll make the prior point that I wasn't able to make, but when you censor these people, and I think you've made this point in particular, when you censor them, you empower them. And building on what you had just said earlier, they can just move on to another platform. When they're empowered, when they're censored, look, he's all over the news. We're talking about him now. He's gaining more notoriety for these idiotic things that he says, and he's going to go to another platform, and he's going to have a greater audience because he was censored. And what I think is extraordinarily dangerous here is not only that these outlets are determining what we can hear and what we cannot hear because of their terms of service and a putative violation of it, but that they were lobbying for the removal of this particular content. And, you know, an outlet for which I've written in the past, in particular CNN, I've read in various reports, was very much in favor of the removal of InfoWars from these particular platforms. And I think that that is dangerous in another level, because it further polarizes the population. If we're not going to have this discourse, this back and forth, that was what the First Amendment was designed to encourage, even if it's abhorrent. This back and forth
but
is
necessary. But where's the back and forth? Where's the dialogue? I'm not seeing the dialogue.
That's a good point, frankly. But, it definitely seems like a one-way street. But the fact that he can exist and there can be dialogue is why the First Amendment exists. There doesn't necessarily have to be. But once we go down this pathway of allowing others to determine what we should and should not hear on the basis of viewpoint, we are contributing to the echo chambers that we decry constantly on this show.
Okay, but, you know, you can't just have, a Nazi site be linked to on Facebook. They have rules and regulations, who is acceptable, who is not, what kinds of calls to action and what kinds of speech violate their terms of service. So how is it okay in one regard but not in another?
I feel like we're having the same conversation we had 2 weeks ago, except you're on the other side of the
the
point now.
I'm seeing people that are saying that, yeah, we should kick anybody out that has, you know, a MAGA hat on. But at the same time, they're the same people objecting to kicking Alex Jones off of Facebook. You can't have it both ways. You know, I think we're being kind of, consistent here in saying that an unpopular opinion is one thing. This goes beyond an unpopular opinion. This is spreading, deliberately spreading false information and calling for all kinds of violent reactions. And basically, it's worlds of difference.
But there's a lot of crossover between the things that Alex Jones posts and people who have a very liberal bent to the point of being kind of libertarian as well. Because once you go full scale around the political spectrum, liberalism begins to look like libertarianism, and you know that's where you get states like Vermont. But a case in point about why I think InfoWars should not be censored, and this is sort of personal to me, is because just under 3 years ago, I wrote an article for The Intercept, and it was about the AT&T NSA partnership that was front page news with the New York Times. And I wrote this article saying, well, look, this is neither new nor illegal. Why is it front page news? It is, however, immoral, because we're talking about a massive increase in surveillance of a degree, not necessarily kind, that should give us all pause. We're not talking about, you know, Operation Shamrock and things like that where there's a few people. And The Intercept loved this article. They thought it was very neat and unique, and they published it. And I thought that was great on them. And then InfoWars republished it. You know, without my consent, but they literally took the entirety of an article from The Intercept that I wrote and put it on InfoWars. To this day, I'm horrified that, you know, when people search for my name, an article on InfoWars can show up if you dig far enough into the
search. Yeah, that would keep me up at nights, for sure.
It should. But it goes to show you that not everything, not all speech that comes from this idiot is idiotic.
But it's not his speech. It's your speech. He just stole it.
That's true. That's true. But it's the posting of it. It's the article.
No, don't you see? You're helping to legitimize them by having your speech be added to their content.
Well, I didn't intentionally do that.
No, but I would object to it if I were you. I mean, I don't want to be affiliated with you in any way because of the horrible things that you spread around.
Yeah, it is abhorrent. But I don't necessarily think that we should leave it to others to determine what we hear. It should be up to us as individuals to make that individual
but
choice.
It is up to us. We are the ones that have been yelling at Facebook, get this guy off, and they finally answered that. So how is it not?
Well, we have, but others have been saying keep him off.
Okay, but with that logic, we'll never get any kind of result because there's always going to be somebody saying don't do that.
Well, that's fine, but then, you know, use the God-given capabilities that you have and that massive amount of gray matter between the headphones and filter it yourself.
So, okay, so your answer is simply to not listen to all the hatred and craziness that's out there, and it's just going to keep being out there for you to see on Fox News or for you to see on Facebook. And don't you see this is like a snowball going down?
No,
a mountain?
I don't.
It's just going to get bigger and bigger, and that is where we are
now.
I think
the fact that the hateful speech is out there and you can see it and you can identify it and call it out for what it is a great thing because it tells you where you stand in relation
to
other
people. It's a great thing for hate speech because there's more of that now than ever.
And it's a great thing for free speech as well because, you know, we can be just as loud on the other side and we can identify those whom we think are abhorrent and those whom we believe we should not listen to or who should be shunned or banned. I mean, it's not hard for an individual to turn off InfoWars, to not go to their site, to, you know, remove them from their Twitter feed or not listen to a Spotify podcast.
Yeah, but it's very hard for an individual not to be affected by it in some way because of the reactions of other people.
Look, I'm not going to disagree with that. I think the same problem that you have with InfoWars is the same problem that we have with the online radicalization of people when it comes to organizations like ISIS. Is that you have people with very weak minds who are untrained in how to use logic and how to spot specious arguments and how to spot logical fallacies.
Okay, well, no, I'm glad you brought this up. ISIS. So an ISIS page on Facebook, no problem?
Well, that's, I think, going beyond. I mean, I think that's equivalent to Nazism because they are actively engaged in acts of terror, plotting against the United States, executing people. InfoWars isn't doing that. I mean, there's a big difference in degree, if not kind, between InfoWars and ISIS. I mean, InfoWars, to my knowledge, has not beheaded anybody and posted a video of it.
Okay, but, white supremacists and Nazis over the years have done quite a few horrible things. And people who enable that kind of speech, that kind of thinking, are helping to legitimize that, helping to inspire future people. Are you saying that if I had an ISIS sympathetic page on Facebook, that would be okay?
Sure.
One where I said, you know, don't actually go out and do this, but this is why, you know, we believe in this and et cetera, et cetera.
Look, I think it would all depend on the content of the page, obviously. If it intended to radicalize people towards ISIS, I would say absolutely not, because you're dealing with an organization advocating the violent overthrow of the U.S. government, violence against civilians. I mean, they're a different brand of hate, I think. They are more equivalent to Nazism. And I think we would all agree, as we did 2 weeks ago, that a hat with a swastika on it would not be allowed at the HOPE conference.
So yeah, you're saying give the InfoWars people a chance.
I'm not saying give them a chance.
I hear you.
Give them the right to speak on whatever platform they want, and we have the right not to listen.
How about give me the right to speak on any platform I want?
Put
me on Fox News, put me on CNN, put me on all these platforms that are censoring me. because, you know, I'm not being printed in the New York Times or, you know, in the Saturday Evening Post. Wait, is that even still coming out? I think that stopped. Yeah. But regardless, I should be able to be heard anywhere I want.
Like
what you're saying this guy has the right to.
The other side of this, though, is that, you know, I'm not contesting the right of Facebook, of YouTube, of any of these private organizations to engage in this particular type of censorship. I think that it's perfectly legal. It's within their rights. They're not a governmental organization.
But isn't that all we're saying? Isn't that what this is about? Do they have the right to do this?
No.
Yes? Okay.
Whether,
move on.
It's about whether it's morally right. Right? There's a difference between having a right to do something and exercising that right in a moral manner.
I think they're finding that the federal government is taking an interest in the people speaking on their platforms, and they're saying, hey, we might give you a second chance this time, and you might want to take a look at your community standards, clean things up a bit, and we'll reassess things because we allowed this. You know, you got to do it the other way. And when it became something that could be exploited by state actors and influence our democratic process, it started disrupting other speech. You know, in other words, it crept. And I think this is actually pressure from the state on private entities for the third and final time before they actually go in and dissolve these companies and platforms.
That's a fascinating theory.
I mean, that's what I'm hearing in this. Yeah. I don't think this is... shame on Facebook, shame on Twitter. They are under scrutiny. This is their last chance before it's vaporized from the market and from social anything. Okay, and like this choice by them to remove InfoWars as like a major megaphone for all of the like creatures of the net, you know, I my argument was not Alex Jones. I also want to clear this up, that he is not, I'm saying, the idiot. I'm saying the people willing to buy his crap. This is who we were afraid of before because we had an election in the way. And we're now afraid of them equally because we really aren't going to give them another chance to do more damage with these platforms. And I think that pressure is from the federal government on these private entities who have then their own standards to compare and apply that to. But this is the onus, the will of the American people in the manifestation of these, you know, Senate committees and so on that are putting pressure on these platforms.
You can join our conversation here. 347-335-0818 is our phone number. Treasure.
Yes, Manuel, you were talking about Fox News earlier. That's different than Twitter and Facebook because they edit what you say. You get in front of their camera, they will edit you in the manner they want to edit you.
That's
and
censorship.
Put you in
that's
with.
Censor. You're censoring me.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
in a manner of speaking.
That's what we're saying with this simplistic way of reacting to quality, you know, standards. Mm-hmm. Things
community
like,
standards, yeah. and the whole case by case thing versus, you know, what are we enforcing across our platform? I think a lot of those notions were never really fixed, and then they were allowed to persist, and that's where we're coming back around saying, nah, not again. You know,
but
if
they,
either you have these standards and enforce them or not,
they don't edit you if you're live, so they can't edit you if you're live.
Well, true, but they take your clips and edit them up and then put them back over the air.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, if Kyle is indeed right, and I think that there is a lot to be said for what he said, and I think it's a great theory about what's happening. If it is the case, though, that the government is putting sort of behind-the-scenes pressure on these particular companies to do this, and we know that they are, in fact, under a lot of pressure to combat, you know, this election muddling and interference and whatnot. If that is the case and they're encouraging this kind of censorship, I think that's somewhat dangerous as well because they need to come out and say that they're doing that. Because then the government is taking a viewpoint and then it becomes state action and then legal challenges can arise and we can deal with this in the courts like reasonable people.
We have a caller joining us. Good evening.
Good evening. I support the decision to take Alex Jones off those platforms. He's very incendiary, and as you pointed out correctly, he does have the means to access another platform to disseminate his propaganda, and I don't feel that Facebook has any obligation to him.
Yeah, you know, in a way, I think this might actually turn out to be good for him because he won't have anybody standing in the way. It'll just be Infowars.com or whatever site he has, and he'll have total control over it, assuming that, you know, he's able to find a provider that doesn't cut him off because of the crap he spews.
Yeah, he would have to then have a provider hosting him. At least at this point, you know, YouTube can be the fall guy, you know, the evildoer, and it's like agnostic as to how he's connecting to YouTube. But were he to host it, then you have to then say, okay, what host is allowing this and why? And then they get the scrutiny, you know. So whoever gets him, if at all, is somehow upstream gonna have the finger pointed at them at some point.
See, in a way, Alex, this is all public pressure. This is all the public voting because it's that pressure that led Facebook and all the others to this decision. It's not the government because the government supports what Alex Jones. Remember what Trump said about Alex Jones, how he was a legitimate journalist or whatever. And believe me, if it was up to Trump, he would have 1,000 Facebook channels.
I don't know if one phone call constitutes the entire public, but look, I agree with you that there's public support for this. There's no doubt about that. We see that in this room. But I do think that it is a scary situation that we're in when we are further encouraging the polarization of our political process and our people and our thoughts and our dialogue.
Well, it's a bit late to be concerned about that because that's been happening now for quite some time.
Yes, thank you for your concern.
I see this as a reaction and a healthy reaction, on the corporate level. And I don't think we would have had this years ago. I don't think corporations would have stepped up like this. But you say one phone call doesn't measure it. Let's take another phone call then, because we do have a bunch. Good evening. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Okay. I don't use any social media, Facebook or Twitter or any of them.
Good for you.
I don't really care what they do.
All right.
But at the same time, it's not Mark Zuckerberg's job to un-gullibalize America, if that's such a word. There's a sucker born every minute, and they're all out there, and a lot of them on Facebook. It's not Zuckerberg's job to fix that.
Well, is it his right to decide who gets to use the system and who doesn't?
Well, some people say it's a private company, but it's really not. It's a public company because it's on the stock exchange.
It's not a utility. Facebook is not a utility. God help us if it was. It's a private company. That, there's no disputing that.
Oh, it's on the stock market. It's a public company.
Fine. So it's a company that's traded on this, but it's not a government utility is what I'm trying to say.
It's not, but then the stockholders, they get to vote on that at the meeting, right?
I don't know. Is this an issue for stockholders to vote on?
But they have to protect their platform, and at the end of the day, that is their users. And if their usership is implicated and gullible, as you said, I was calling them, you know, idiots, but these are audience members of Alex Jones, then permeating the rest of that platform with people who are also gullible but may not directly consume his product, then yes, I think, and I think this is maybe what you're saying, is that Facebook has a right to enforce that as a community standard, or maybe you're disagreeing. You're saying you don't care what they do, and they shouldn't have that right. I mean, if they're a private company, they should have that right. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they're not a private company. They're a public company.
That
fits in somewhere.
There's a difference between a public company and a public utility.
A public company, but a private platform.
That comes under the Public Service Commission. They're not under the Public Service.
I misspoke. Right? Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So you're in favor of Alex Jones remaining on Facebook?
As I said, I really don't care either way because I don't use it. And if I did, I wouldn't listen to him anyway, saying that the Sandy Hook thing didn't.
But you're saying that it's not the responsibility of the platform if people are so gullible, which is fair. But, you know, the company is responsible also, you know, to the shareholders. But its existence, it relies on those people not being disintegrated and them existing and so on. So if they want to protect their audience and their usership in a way they see fit, some of us are saying that is within their right.
You see, it's easy to say that, let them be on Facebook. I just won't listen. But what if your uncle resends something that is posted or links It's a very pervasive manner of communications, and you know, I think we see this all the time.
Yeah, what happens when your uncle says, "Hey, you know, we're going to start a checkpoint in the neighborhood to remove illegals. You know, you got to come out and meet us at Dunkin', you know, whatever."
Why there?
You know, whatever the plan is, uh-huh. when people start using these platforms and as a result of their gullibility to act in your neighborhood, what is your mood then?
All right, I'm going to make a point here. I feel like I have to. But and I
make you have the phone number one more time, 347-335-0818. Go ahead.
We need one more arbiter of public opinion.
We have one.
My goodness,
I'm going to put them on hold. Go ahead.
My point here is that I'm going to predict that this is going to be used against us, that we're going to be – that not necessarily I will, but you guys are going to be eating your words – 2 years from now.
What you're saying, we're going to say, oh, boy, I wish Alex Jones was still on Facebook.
No, that viewpoint discrimination by these particular private entities determining what we can and can't see on these platforms is a bad idea because it's going to affect the left, too.
Yeah, but when,
we are organizing and trying to rally,
of course,
and people may be engaging in something like civil disobedience, you know, during the 2020 election, think about that. That will
but
also
not, we're
be
not, we're not,
censored.
We're not talking about that kind of thing where you're participating in a demonstration or an action or something like that. We're talking about hate speech. We're talking about Holocaust denial. We're talking about awful things that only lead to more awful things.
This is
talking about
lead.
And
conspiracies.
This is a way to make it not be galvanized and gather strength and become so ugly and powerful that it's almost unstoppable.
This will lead to the eradication of organizing online. This will lead to censorship of organizers. It will lead to people who want to engage in civil disobedience and peaceful protests in any forum being censored by these particular platforms because they're going to claim, well, this might end erupt in violence. This might erupt in a riot, and therefore it violates our terms of service and our terms of use.
I think
and
that's
you're going
such
to be shut down
a distinction
because then you're dealing with viewpoint. And think about back to the days of Martin Luther King and what he called for in the civil disobedience during the civil rights era.
Mm-hmm.
That would have violated Facebook's terms
I
of
don't,
service.
I don't really think so. But let's talk to another caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Alex. I sent you an email like 2 weeks ago. I know you're busy with the birth of your child, but when you get a chance, could you send me a link to that PowerPoint of your presentation about cyber squatting Trump?
Sure, absolutely. If you can resend that to me, it probably is buried somewhere in my inbox, but send that to me again, and I'd be happy to do that.
Other
Thank
than,
you for the
than
reminder.
Pestering Alex to send you an email, do you have an opinion on this?
No, yeah, of course. I think Alex Jones is a menace, and I think he doesn't – I don't think it's censorship. I think he's a horrible person, and I agree with you, but there are other ways for him to get his message of hate out. Facebook doesn't need to help him. He has other means to do it. He's a wealthy guy, and unfortunately, his garbage will be with us for many generations to come, so –
Well said, and unfortunately, sadly said, but thank you for that call, and thank you
thank
for the
you.
Email to Alex that you'll now resend. Facebook helped make Alex Jones the demon he is.
Facebook helped elect Trump.
That's true. That's very true. But even that is something that I know we can't stop, but you can stop hate speech. You can stop calls to violence and just awful things like what he stands for. So that's my point. We'd like to hear what listeners have to say. OTH at 2600.com. Hey, how come we're not on Facebook? Apparently, it's very popular with the kids.
There's plenty of 2600 groups on Facebook.
Well, I know that, but I mean, our show needs to be on Facebook. If he just vacated a bunch of space on Facebook now. So then they have space for us now. How do we get? Can someone out there help us with this? Put us on Facebook so people will be trying to get us taken down.
And maybe I'll post a picture of my new child.
That sounds, yeah, that you should
Let's
do that.
Full
it's,
circle
it's,
here.
You have the obligation. Hey, we're out of time. Stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show coming up next. And we will be here in as soon as I figure out why the CD player is not playing. Okay, that's why. Because somebody had the wrong button pushed in. We'll be back next week. OTH at 2600.com. Don't forget to pledge to WBAI 516-620-3602. Tell them Off the Hook is your favorite show, or at least the show that made you want to call. And become a WBAI buddy. give2wbai.org. And you can also text to 41444 with the letters WBAI. This is Emmanuel for Off the Hook. Have a good night.
WBAI New York 99.5 FM. This is 8-9 o'clock on WBAI, and it's time for the Personal Computer Show. And here we go with this.
Today is August the 8th, 2018. This is our anniversary show. After a completion of 35 years, bringing you what's new in personal computing. Our first broadcast was August the 4th, 1983. We thank you, the listeners, who have supported this program. Tonight, we have an anniversary program prepared to go over in the shortest time possible the last 35 years. By the way, do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King. And in the studio with me this evening is Stevie Deeby on the audio control panel. Podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. Before we get on with the show, we have a little housekeeping to do. We've been asked, what premiums are we offering to encourage you to financially support the station? Well, the technical information on the show each week that we give is in itself a premium of value. We cover technical issues that are consumer-oriented. We have no problems giving a thumbs down on products or services, as we are listener and consumer-supported. The Personal Computer Show has offered premiums in the past. However, with limited staff, the station has difficulty processing premiums in a timely fashion. To address this issue, we will proactively do something different on our end. Our premiums have in the past been offered on CD and DVD formats. In the future, we will only ask you to send us a confirmation of your donation during the fund drive for a WBAI Buddy Support or a donation for your favorite show of $50 or more. Of course, we're referring to the Personal Computer Show as your favorite show. We will then notify you of the premium in the cloud and the online address to download it. This eliminates the time delay in the process. In this manner, we cut out the middleman and more efficiently deliver to you the premium. For those who make a donation this evening of a WBAI Buddy or a donation of $50 or more for your favorite show, you will be eligible to download the next premium we offer on or before the next fundraising event. I'm presently compiling and building a comprehensive PC troubleshooting toolkit as a premium. It will not be offered as a premium, but rather as a personal thank you from the Personal Computer Show staff, from us to you, and we really, really do appreciate your support. At this time, we ask you to support WBAI all year round with a generous monthly donation. A WBAI Buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit or debit card. It's safe, secure, simple, automatic, and it means a great deal to keeping our unique and high-quality programming on the air. Once you've joined, you will receive a BAI Buddy card and WBAI tote bag. The card allows you to participate in the many member benefits, including discounts offered by our WBAI Buddy partners. You can also show your appreciation for the Personal Computer Show by becoming a sponsor. Make a one-time donation in the name of your favorite WBAI show. The pledge line number is 516-620-3602. Let me repeat that again. The pledge line number is 516-620-3602.
Personal Computer Show, there was three of us. There was David Burstein, Joe King, and myself, Hank Key. And David Burstein...
Okay.
Yeah,
remember
Dave, I just want to introduce you that we haven't heard from you in a long time. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, we really thought things would be much better.
Well,
and what's happened since 1982?
Well, actually, we started in 1983, and you went off and started your own business and very successful at it in 1999. And Dave,
actually, I was never very good at business, but I did interesting things, and I've met interesting people, and I've learned a lot.
Well, a lot of people have been asking, how's Dave doing, and what's he doing, and... they'd like to hear your voice.
Well, I meet interesting people, do interesting things. In the next 2 months, I get to go to London, Geneva, and Shanghai. And I'm doing my best to throw a monkey wrench into the Sprint T-Mobile merger. And I understand what 5G really is. And I know the people who are making it. So I have an interesting life. Never managed to get rich.
Let me ask you two simple questions then. Why do you feel that the Sprint T-Mobile should not be merged? And the other question is, how long do we have to wait for 5G?
I didn't hear the second one. What was that?
How long do we have to wait for 5G?
For us, anything meaningful in 5G isn't going to happen for a couple of years. Yes, it's unlikely to come heavily in New York. 4G, remember, is doing 500 megabits here in Manhattan, about 20 blocks away from where I'm sitting. So I think 500 megabits or 300 megabits, which is what 4G is up to, is perfectly fine for most practical purposes. Which answers the first question, that T-Mobile is already doing hundreds of megabits in Manhattan. So why should we kill competition in order to make this thing called 5G that is comes in two flavors? One flavor is the millimeter wave that Verizon is doing, and that's going to get around slow. And it probably will get to your neighborhood in Queens before it gets to me in Manhattan, because it's not going to do that well with too many tall buildings. That's going to be real fast. 90% of what they're calling 5G is really 4G with a little piece of software called NR, and it makes it 15%, maybe 50% faster. Now, let me ask you a question. What could you do if your internet was running at 350 megabits that you couldn't do if the internet was running at 250 megabits?
Well, I'll answer this question very simply by saying in my neighborhood, 3:30 in the afternoon when all the kids are technically in the library or at home, I'm lucky to even get 25.
Well, that's being fixed anyway. You don't need 5G for that. That's what's being delivered more and more around the world with four antennas, NEMO, using more spectrum. Remember, as it is, Verizon isn't even using more, half of this spectrum. And maybe even more antennas for you really needed, a couple of small cells. And most of the world's going to get a few hundred megabits now.
Well,
5G was going to be a big thing when they were going to do millimeter wave. It was going to be a true gigabit. I don't know if that's going to make a difference. But what they did is about a year ago in Barcelona in particular, 3GPP, decided to put the name 5G that everybody thought was going to be great on the 4G that was coming in anyway. And in fact, all the phone companies are upgrading because they'd be stupid not to. It costs an enormous amount to build a network. It doesn't cost much more to build it well. And in fact, we had the guy from T-Mobile, Legere.
Jean Legere, right.
I'm sorry?
Jean Legere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very colorful. Lies even more than politicians do. Happens to be building a pretty good network. And a year ago, before this merger came on, he said he'd be building 5G to a couple of hundred megabits across the whole country. The whole country, nationwide, was the word he used. And then suddenly, when they wanted to get rid of a competitor and get Sprint out of the way, he says he can't build the fast network without the merger. So it's really funny. He told everybody, including investors, where it's stupid to lie, that he was going to upgrade the whole system to 5G. And now he's trying to tell Washington that he can't do it. So either he lied to investors or he's lying to the FCC. It happens to be the latter. And that's why there's no reason to approve Sprint T-Mobile. And we live in a capitalist society, which means we really need competition or they're going to rip us off.
Hey, Dave, I have a question for you. What's your schedule, because you travel around a lot, what's your schedule like next month? Because what I'd love to do is get you back on the air with us.
I've got a microphone that I have to replace, so you're going to have to speak up a little.
Okay. What I'm asking is that when can why don't you email me when you're available? What I'd like to do is you know, spend a heck of a whole lot more time talking with you and get some updates from you.
Whichever and whenever. I'm still here in New York. I'm not doing very much most Wednesday evenings.
Okay.
Let me give you a sense, though. How is what I was thinking of. You said we're going to come in. So I started thinking, what is the difference in the world now and then? And the difference then is that Hanke would spend hours and hours and hours putting together free software. The service was what he believed in. And now we have a world where getting rich in Silicon Valley is what people believed in. And unfortunately, the Internet is responsible for a lot of that. Because the Internet is winner-take-all. There's only one